Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 62 with the good Reverend John Flack, pastor at Our Savior's Atonement in Washington Heights. But I have to tell you, this is the last episode of the podcast being edited and dealt with in my home, where I've lived with my wife, Stephanie Kirshner, for the last 8 years in Scarsdale. I call it the Lord's house. It's the parsonage next to the church where my wife is the pastor. It's been a good home. We've hosted a lot of good friends here. And we've had our good friend John here, and I felt it appropriate that the last conversation that I have, that I listened to in this house, before I moved to the new one, is with the man of the cloth, a good friend of my wife, who she introduced me to, John Flack. John's a great guy, smart dude, traveled the world, grew up in many, many places, but before we get to him, I gotta let you know that this podcast is brought to you by Liquid Drum. No, it's not liquid rum, though that's what it looks like. Nope, it's Liquid Drum. There's a little dash in there. Anyway, they're all about percussion and community, and they're a small organization. They spread big ideas through drums, percussion, music in general. Whether through performing, teaching, or simple sharing, Liquid Drum value. There you go, Bono. Liquid Drum values the communal aspects of creating music while having a good time while doing it. There you go. Talking about Todd here, Bono. Todd Meehan, check him out. LiquidDrum.com. LiquidRum.com. You check out their video library on YouTube and Vimeo. All right. Kyle Dunleavy. I'm a big fan of that dude just as a person. He's a great guy, but he's also a great tuner. Great builder. Tuner and builder of what, you say, Josh? Well, steel drums. It's been in my life since I was in high school, thanks to Joan Wenzel. People like Cliff Alexis, Ellie Bennett, and Kyle Dunleavy. I'd toss him in the mix there. He's a student of all those guys in one way or another. He's worked with bands down in Trinidad. He's worked with bands in Brooklyn. Kyle has a low E second that I play, double seconds that I play, and he makes a low G for Victor Provost, and he's currently making me a low C set of seconds. So stuff is consistent. And if you got a band that just needs blending, Kyle's your guy. DunleavyPans.com. DunleavyPans.com. pans.com. Finally, Small World Coffee. If you live in Princeton and you fancy yourself a loyal person, well, go down, shake Vin's hand down there in the Witherspoon location. You might also go to the Nassau Street location. Seems to me that the employees that work there love it. Which tells me that their bosses love it, and that the culture there is pretty great. Food's great, coffee's great. Oh, maybe you don't live in Princeton. That's totally fine. Go to smallworldcoffee.com. Check them out on Twitter and Facebook. And you can order all the beans you want. They'll ship them right to you. smallworldcoffee.com. Okay. You know, I've grown up around religion my whole life in one way or another. I was raised Catholic, went through Sunday school, went to a Catholic church every Sunday of my life, all major holidays. Did the reconciliation where you go and you sort of confess your sins, guilt, all that stuff, kneeling, big old bloody Jesus hanging there. And when I went to college, I basically swore off religion. Didn't swear it off. I was just like, I'm not going to go on Sundays. So I didn't go at all. And lo and behold, I married a Lutheran pastor. Stephanie Grace Kirshner, the love of my life. Well, about 10 years after meeting her, she introduces me to a good friend of hers that she met at what they call a baby pastor school, a guy named John Flack. He's a pastor at Our Savior's Atonement in Washington Heights. So enjoy this conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, John Flack. All right. All right, you can hear yourself okay?
Yeah. I'm a little, like, echoey. It's always funny to hear yourself recorded because you don't sound anything like...
I know. Everybody's like, your voice sounds so low. I was like, I don't feel like my voice.
You have a very beautiful podcast voice. I was listening to some just to kind of get practice.
You have a very good preacher voice.
Thank you.
And that's exactly what you are. At least, or do you call yourself a pastor?
I say pastor.
You say pastor.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a pastor and a preacher?
I feel like a preacher just preaches, and a pastor's got to do a lot of stuff. Like, you actually have to talk to people who are dying or want to ask you about crazy questions about God. And your
preachers
office.
Don't. They're like
Kenneth Copeland. That's right. You get like you have to ask God to get you your private plane so you can.
Did you? I'll formally introduce you in a second, but I do before I do that, I really want to talk to you. So, John Flack,
that's me.
You are. I know you. You're a good friend of Stephanie's, who you met at your first year.
Yeah, baby pastor school.
Yeah, that's. But what is it officially called? Not baby pastor
school. Well, it's not. It doesn't exist anymore in our region. It was called First Call Theological Education.
That's right. And where was that?
Some godforsaken place in Pennsylvania. It was at a some Catholic like convent that was, you know, it's now a retreat center.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And you guys would have to go there to do like your first year pastor orientation.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. But we had to do it for 3 years.
Okay. And that's in Stephanie. You and Stephanie met there, and Stephanie is my wife.
Right.
And you're both fellow pastors, and I've known you through her, and we've hung out a million times, and we've chewed the fat on God and Scotch and Trump and a variety of things. And now we're talking about bloodlust and fighting.
Yeah.
But now you're formally introduced. John Flack, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Josh.
What do you think about Kenneth Copeland? That's his name, right?
I don't think about him.
No, did you see that clip that's been going
around?
Wasn't
it some... it was a reporter who was asking him...
Inside Edition.
She's asking him, do you think it's good? And you could see like he had this like... blank-eyed saber-toothed tiger smile, and
I think
he was
we call that plastic surgery.
From
the Lord.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of the clip. It was kind of painful, you know. And he has like these tricks he uses on TV and with people, and I think that she wasn't having it.
Well, the thing that was the most disturbing. Stephanie has been. She complains about the prosperity gospel. And a lot. And I hadn't known about Kenneth Copeland until I saw this viral clip, and it's not a clip, it's 12 minutes, like it's a 12 minute long interaction, which is I think the clip that has been going around is only like 30 seconds, but for 12 minutes you're watching what I would call the Antichrist sort of defend this idea. Like, I think she said something like your quote was, you don't want to get into an airplane with demons. You don't want to get into a commercial airplane with demons.
Right.
Do you think your parishioners are demons? And there's one point where he snaps at her and is like, don't you ever say that again. Like, points at her and is yelling, and then stops and does this like...
this smile. Yeah, exactly. It's like all sort of like personality recedes into your teeth. It's kind of creepy.
It was remarkable. So I went and watched one of his services. Not the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't quite get through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh... all right, like that's a skill. It's a skill set he's developed
exactly
to get into that. But your gospel is not the prosperity gospel.
I hope not.
As far as I can tell,
I hope not.
Can you tell us a little bit about like just yourself, where you're from, and sort of what led you to the current career you have?
Yeah, so I'm part of. I come from a long line of Lutheran pastors. My great-great-grandfather on my mom's side moved to the United States from Germany to be a pastor of the German immigrants on the plains. Mm-hmm. And then his son was a pastor, and his son was a pastor, and his son was a pastor. And then my grandfather, had three daughters. And they came of age about the time when our denomination decided to start ordaining women.
Mm. And, when was that?
I believe it was either 75 or 77.
Okay. That's when the Lutheran Church decided to ordain women?
At that time, it was the ALC, the American Lutheran Church.
And now it's the ELCA?
Correct. They formed with a couple other Lutheran bodies to make the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And so he had three daughters, and two. They all swore they would never marry pastors. And then two of them married pastors, and one of them happened to be my dad. And and so I kind of grew up in that milieu. I tell people, like, at some people's families, they go and they talk about football or I don't know what around the. We always talked about, like, the hymn book and, like, the new liturgies coming out and how terrible they were and, you know, whatever theological
thing.
Shit
talking the liturgy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what happens around pastor's dinner table.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, that's what we did. That was all my mom's side. And I kind of, so I also, when my dad's first call, so I was born in 1980, when my dad was just about to go to seminary, just started seminary. No, it was just before he started seminary. And his first call was to, what we call call, we mean job as a pastor, was in Madagascar. Mm. And so we moved to France when I was five because Madagascar was a French colony and they have a lot of tribal languages. And so you first learn French because that's like the educated class in Madagascar will speak French and French will get you places. And then when you move to Madagascar, then you learn Malagasy. And then
Malagasy.
Yep. You'll see, for instance, in the grocery store, things will say Madagascan vanilla. That is incorrect. If anybody's listening here and does like vanilla branding, it's Malagasy vanilla. It's not Madagascan. Anyway, so we moved to Madagascar after half a year in France and spent about 4.5 to 5 years in Madagascar, where I ended up going to boarding school. But I think that was really, when I think about like why I became a pastor, that's one of the reasons, because one of my most vivid memories is going with my dad. His job was to support the Malagasy pastors who are in Madagascar. So his job was to help in whatever way that he could support them, which chiefly meant that he was a conduit for money, which is a whole other problem. But anyway, we went on a big trip. We drove a four-wheel drive truck, and then we went. Should I shut the window for the cars? We went on a four-wheel drive truck, and then we got out of the truck, and we got into canoes, and then we walked to this church that was built out of just basically four, like a frame, and palm branches were the walls and the ceiling, and they didn't have any pews or anything. We just had a worship service, and I just remember as a kid being very convinced that this was a real thing. It was a true thing, what we were doing together. And when I got back to the States, I kind of missed the whole 80s thing. Mm-hmm. So,
For better or worse.
For better or worse. You know, I was growing up in a boarding school in Madagascar, so, like, I didn't have TV. I didn't go home and watch cartoons. I got the tail end of the slap bracelets. Okay, I had a yellow, green, and orange striped one.
All right, you had
but I didn't know. Like, I didn't know who, like, you know, John Elway was, or I didn't know who Michael Jordan was when I got back to the States. You know, so I had to learn all that stuff.
Saved by the bell.
Look, here's what happened. I was still wearing my socks up to my knees when I got back. You know, and the short shorts with the piping, and like this was 1990. That was not going anywhere. You know,
you were Madagascar hit.
Yeah, I was totally hit for Madagascar, but not for Belleville, Kansas, and. So the church kind of gave me, even though we didn't really have like any youth group or anything like that, I think it was the liturgy that kind of gave me like this grounding and kind of an understanding of sort of God's presence, you know. And I just kind of grew up with that. So we moved again in Iowa, and I never really felt like I had I was in the right place until I went to school in the University of Chicago. And even there, like the church I went to, it was between pastors. They had an interim, and she was terrible. I mean, no offense, but like I did not connect with that person. Mm-hmm. I should say it that way. I did not connect with that person. And but then what I saw happen was they got a new pastor in later, and that person became my mentor in a lot of ways. Mm. And I saw what happens when leadership comes into a church and helps, and it transformed that place. And it was just, I guess I felt very called, you know. So. Mm. I guess, and also just sort of the way that I look at the world, I kind of think human beings are kind of rotten in general. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need help. So that's sort of where I come from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you say you felt like you felt that it was what you were doing was true, like how old were you at this time?
In that moment I was probably 8 or 9.
Like, what is the concept of God or a larger presence for a 9-year-old versus 9-year-old Jonathan versus how old are you now?
39.
So 30 years ago. Yeah. So like what over 30 years, how has that concept morphed for you?
I think one part has stayed the same, which is this this capacity for loving that you can feel but don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt that in a lot of times, that there's like this universal power of love that can overcome anything. Mm-hmm. That's never changed for me. But I think what has changed for me is the concept of suffering, that the love that, you know, we receive through that is also something that we also feel when we suffer with one another person. Mm. So I think, you know, as a kid, you go through stuff, I think, and you don't really understand what's going on. Like, you know, if your parents fought a lot, or, you know, you don't feel right at school, or you see things on TV that don't make sense. I think for me, that's one of the things that I've come to believe, is that's God is most present in suffering, not in prosperity or anything like that. It's actually more about, the power of God is revealed in the brokenness of the world, not in its, yeah.
Where does religion, I mean, I think about this a lot. I mean, I'm not a person of the cloth, yeah. The clergy.
Good for you.
But, you know, being married to one, I'm around it a lot. So I think a lot about like the origins of religion. Like, when did the first religion start? Like, talk to me about the beginnings of, like, what are the instincts that human beings have to even form a religion?
I have no idea. I did read the article about an evolutionary biologist. Mm. And if I have it right, he says, let me put it to you this way before I go into that. I don't think religion necessarily, well, let me go a step back from that even. I think that I agree with this theologian called Karl Barth, who says that Christianity is not a religion. Mm. It's either true or it's not. And if it's true, then it's like, it's not a system of belief. It's sort of like a discovery. Mm-hmm. It's like a revelation, an unveiling of something that is like the fundamental networking of the universe. So it's not a system of symbols or anything like that, you know? So I think I agree with that. On the other hand, religion as such, you know, this is me just total bullshitting now, but this is the best that I got. I read this article by this evolutionary biologist guy who wrote this book called Catching Fire.
Who was it?
And Catching Fire is a book about why cooking is, like, how human beings evolved with cooking.
Oh, yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
The advent of fire, like cooking meat and vegetables, yeah. Especially. Like, yeah. There's something about the amount of energy you right. have to expend to chew and digest raw foods.
Yeah.
Would mean that your brain, your right.
would lack,
organs would yeah. have to work so much to digest that stuff that you wouldn't have time to, like, be a pastor,
exactly,
or make weird cave percussion paint. Music. Yeah, yeah, you would only have time to just kill the mammoth, eat it, sleep, go back out.
Yeah, you'd be a panda bear,
right?
Essentially,
and when we can cook things, it heightens your body's absorption of proteins,
right?
Proteins,
as it like digests proteins. Like, it's like a pre-digested method,
right?
Yeah.
But then that's when our brains sort of swelled to the exactly. size they got. That's yeah. why we have the intellectual capacities yeah. compared to, you know, yeah. Chimps and monkeys yeah. and stuff. And
yeah. So he had a new book last year. I don't remember the title. I just read a review of it. He also wrote this book called Demonic Apes, which I think is just a great title. I'd read that book, you know, if I could find it. But what he said was that morality developed because of an alpha male problem, where you had these like big scary dudes like killing everybody, mm-hmm. and the rest of the dudes were like, we want a mate, and we want to pass on our genes, and this guy's getting in our way. And so the less alpha people got together and like killed the big ones, and so that the, you know, they could disperse, I don't know, their gene pool or whatever. And so in order to justify that, they had to come up with a reason, and eventually that reason developed into sort of like universal laws, like morality laws. They had to have like when is it okay to kill the alpha male, when yeah. is it not, and that kind of, you know, evolved into a system of morality. And I think I might be wrong about this, but I think that also includes like religion. But again, I don't think religion is necessarily morality primarily. I think morality, like the most moral people probably, I mean, I think sometimes it doesn't really have much to do with religion.
No, do you know who Sam Harris is?
I know who Sam Harris is, yeah. I don't really read him, but I know him.
Of
him.
I listen, that's what you asked, what podcast, there's a yeah. podcast he has called Making Sense,
yeah.
where he has conversations with all people all over the map, you
right.
know, not just, he talks a lot about consciousness and, right. and things, and he's a pretty avid atheist.
Yeah. He's one of the, what do they call those guys? The Hitchkins.
He's in that camp. Yeah. He considers himself a philosopher and a thinker. Right. And I would too. And I don't agree with most of the sort of the premise of his argument about religion is to me a little bit like I get what you're saying, but like you're discounting all this other stuff that comes with religion. But his whole thing is like you can be a moral person without the constructs of a church or a community.
Yeah, all you got to do is love something other than yourself.
Right. But when you were talking about the less alpha, the betas kill the alphas, that happens in the animal kingdom all the time. And I listen to hunting podcasts as well, and I'm not a hunter, but when they talk about like Cecil the lion that was killed, I don't know, a couple of years ago or whatever in Africa, or when there's a big, a giraffe there was a woman who killed a giraffe and everybody went crazy, except that giraffe was an old male that was killing any other young viable male. The old male who was not breeding was actually going to decimate the population if it wasn't taken out, so that the younger ones could come in and mate and keep propagating the population. The idea that humans are any different. I mean, this is the thing that I think about all the time when I read about evolutionary biology is like, just because we learn how to cook our food doesn't mean that like our deep, deep DNA isn't telling us to do those same things on some level. We have these morality structures that we've built.
Which is good. I mean, I don't know. So, totally. so this evolutionary, I wish I could remember the darn guy's name.
It's not Eric Weinstein, is it?
I don't remember. I really don't remember. I could look it up real fast, but he wrote the book Catching Fire, whatever that guy is. He actually compares two different ape populations, the bonobo apes, which are extremely peaceful, and the chimps.
Who are not.
And
well, chimps are the ones that are like tear your hands off and stuff.
Yeah, like, those guys are like, they're mean, I guess. But the bonobos are not. They're like a matriarchal, I guess. If I'm remembering.
Suzanne Collins?
No.
Wait, that's the Catching Fire. That's one of the books in the Hunger Games series.
Oh, that's right.
Sorry.
I mean, yeah, similar, right? So there's
it's the only one that comes up.
Yeah.
Maybe,
so I must have said the wrong title.
Something the Hunger Games is another good series, though.
That's right. You should
read about morality tales.
Oh, man. What is that guy's name? Cooking.
Sacrificing your family members to go into the... What do they call it? It's not the Purge. It's the...
Hold on. Yeah, it's the... The Purge is a different one.
It's a different movie.
How Cooking Man is Human. Yeah, it is Catching Fire. That's the name of the book. And it is by... Richard Wrangham.
Okay, all right.
Richard Wrangham. Anyway, that's why I don't think like humans are shaved apes. Really, I mean, but at the same time, I do believe that there's something special about us too. Like, there's clearly something special about. I mean, we've terraformed the planet. I mean, we've changed the climate of this planet. Like, I don't know any other species that's done that.
Do you think that any other species would have done the same thing if they'd had the same? I mean, you look at the thing about evolutionary biology is that it's not. It's not a, like, if this, then that. Like, the butterfly effect, like, there's no reason. The only reason we're here is because every decision that was made prior to you and me sitting down was made.
Right.
And those aren't always calculated. You're not always thinking what's happening 10 years down the road.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think, like bonobo apes, if they had, like, figured it out?
Well, we were shrews. I mean, we were tiny little mole people.
Yeah.
Not even people. We were these tiny little things burrowing under the ground that, because we survived through the millennia, nobody ate us.
And we had a good sense to mate with Neanderthals, apparently.
Yeah. And we survived. I mean, do you listen to Radiolab?
Not much, no. Yeah.
There's a one called Dinopocalypse, and they talk about...
Is that one, the asteroid, and they talk about what happened with the dinosaurs?
Well, and the new theories that are coming out about this research, or from this research, are that the dinosaurs died in 3 hours.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Like, the thing hit in Chichen Itza or wherever it hit, and dinosaurs in New Zealand...
Were dead.
...died hours later.
Wow.
Because it, like, shot all this sand and molten sand, basically gas, and when it went into space, it... got cold again and fell back down because of gravity. But as it falls, sand turns to, and when it heats up, it turns to glass. And
so all this glass like killed the dinosaurs? Like
it just rained superheated glass for a very short amount of time and turned the earth into a pizza oven.
Good gravy.
And basically cooked everything on the surface of the earth at the temperature, like it was like 1800 degrees, whatever like a really good pizza oven's at. And so nothing survived. And except for
little mammals in holes.
Little shrews that
who are hiding from dinosaurs. Yeah.
I mean, they ruled the world for like hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah.
And regardless of what god they worshipped or whatever, like if that was us, let's reverse the roles and that was us and we're all just like, God's got us. Everything's good.
Well, except you know what they say in the old spiritual.
What?
God sent Noah a rainbow sign. No more water but the fire next time.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's Oh Mary, Don't You Weep, I think. It's one of my favorite lines of song.
Well, let's start with you. What do you tell yourself on a bad day?
About what?
When you're questioning what's going on.
You mean about the world?
About God, well, first of all, do you question the existence of God?
I did once.
Not anymore?
Not anymore, no.
Why? What, are you willing to talk about that?
Yeah, I was, you know, I was a teenager, and I was like, is God real? And I was like, yeah.
What?
That's pretty much my... Sorry.
No, that's good. Well, why, I mean, why, well, why don't you? Let me ask you that.
I just don't. I mean, the older I get, the more I'm convinced that belief in God isn't rational. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know people who've argued their way into God. And when I do find people like that, I'm a little worried about them.
Argued their way
into God. Like,
what does that mean?
Like proved God exists for them by an intellectual, rational argument. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it happens. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is people have a, you know, I want to use the word spiritual or emotional or some kind of gap. And the only thing that can fill that somehow, like there's like some sort of like, it's like you're looking for the right dongle to plug into your computer, you know, and only one thing will work and that's it. And then suddenly you connect to God. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's kind of a mystery. And I don't know how to explain it other than that that's just God at work. And I just don't think that for me, I've never, you know, once I had that little, you know, my whole life I've believed in God. And I just, I mean, sociologically, like there's this guy named Christian Smith who does some sociological work. I mean, I had a father who believed in God. I went to church every Sunday. And then when I was a teenager, my parents made me go to church, even though I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. And like, those are like all the social memes or whatever they are to make you believe later in life. And none of my experiences, I guess, all the things that I hate about myself or the ways I disappointed myself or anything like that has always been, it's led me closer to God in the end in a way. And I think, so if when I think about the world as it is now, I mean, one of the things I think about, I feel that I'm not a culture warrior. Like, I don't necessarily believe that Christianity needs to be like, we don't need a cultural Christianity. I think that's an idolatry. Mm-hmm. I think Christianity needs to provide a voice and a witness to truth and to beauty and to love in the world that is often cruel. And that's our job. Our job's not to like be culture warriors in any sense. The church is the culture we should build. And every other culture will pass. You know, every other tribe, nation. I mean, the Bible is full of these images of like every tribe, every nation, every culture coming, you know, to be before God and to join together in a song. And I guess that's what I believe. I mean, that's my life experience. Like, I've been in the Midwest. I've lived in Chicago. I now live in New York. I've been in Tanzania. I've been in Argentina. I've been all over the place worshiping God in all different languages and with all different kinds of people. And I believe in that truth that is greater than anything else. And I just, that's the way I make sense of the world. And I guess the world doesn't make sense to me if I don't have that. So I don't let go of it.
I think when you say making sense of the world, like those are things that, I mean, when I think about the roots of religion, like why anybody would get together and try to like, I mean, I know that there's a lot of politics that went into writing the Bible. Like it's the Bible as we know it is not the only stuff that was written at the time. There was stuff written by women. There was stuff written about women kissing Jesus and all the stuff that
didn't. Yeah, that was a lot later, though, than the stuff we have now.
But it just, it didn't quite make the cut at the end of the day.
No.
And for many reasons.
Yeah.
Many reasons which we're still parsing out today in society about relationships between men and women. But
And men and men and women and women.
Totally.
Yeah.
But if I was, let's say, 2,000 years ago, around the time, when would you say around the time of Jesus was?
Yeah, you got it.
About 2,000 years. I just took a shot in the dark.
Yeah, I mean,
close. A ballpark.
Yeah, he would have been about 19, right? Supposedly.
Yeah. So let's say I'm a 19-year-old kid, and Jesus is about to disappear for 30 years, 10 years, his formative years, and I'm trying to figure out why the earth is, why there's huge booms in the sky.
Yeah.
Why it rains a lot all of a sudden with no explanation, what a hurricane is, what a tornado is, what a tsunami is, like all these things that science now
can explain
to us, like a tsunami. When I hear the story of the Red Sea,
yeah,
I think, well, I mean, just what if it was this astronomically small chance that they happened to be standing there when a tsunami, like an earthquake under the Red Sea happened?
Yeah. You know?
Like, I don't literally believe that Moses hit his stick on a rock in the in an ocean parted. That's just not, as far as the laws of physics are concerned, throughout the universe that we know now, thanks to people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Neil Armstrong and other people who have gone out there to show that stuff doesn't act differently.
Well, people knew that back then.
Did they, though?
Yeah.
They knew, like, I just have a hard time believing that this happened. They're like, no, yeah. Like, they had to explain it somehow. And initially, at least in the Old Testament, I imagine a lot of that stuff came from fear. Like, you're terrified. You think you've pissed off
the Lord.
The Lord.
Yeah. Some of it, yeah. And you should still be scared of God, I think, a little bit. I mean, it's like your dad in some way. I mean, your dad, I don't know. I'm growing up, I was a little scared of dad sometimes. And my mom. I think I was more scared of disappointing mom, you know, disappointing dad. But I think that people in the ancient times are smarter than we give them credit for. And I think that they didn't have the scientific method, but they had different ways of understanding the world. And if you were, say, 19 years old at the time of Jesus, you had options. You could have gone to, like, the Cynic school of philosophy, and like, a lot of what the, you know, you see the apostles, I mean, they were competing, in some sense, for audiences with the Cynic philosophers. They did the same thing. They'd leave their home, leave everything behind. They'd take a stick and a bag. And, I mean, the Bible describes it that way, I think, because people knew about a whole class of people that did that kind of stuff and went around and, and philosophized. And I think that, you know, the stories of, like, creation and the flood and the Red Sea, you know, as they were composed, weren't necessarily meant to be taken literally by the people who composed them and by the people who heard them at first. I mean, I think, like if you think about the ways, I don't know how you think about movies or books or novels or stuff, but I love movies and novels that help me understand the world. I mean, they're not true, right? So, like, you know, War and Peace is not true. Exactly. Now, those characters are, except for the Prince Alex, whatever his name is, they're not really real. But what it says is real, I think. What it talks about, human relationships, and this idea that history is bigger than any one force, and that things are beyond human control in a lot of ways. As you were saying before, like, all these choices have led up to us sitting here, and we didn't have any input in that stuff.
Right.
And we make choices that have consequences we don't know, you know, all that stuff. And I think people back then kind of knew that. And I don't think it was necessarily, you know, fear and control, as more as, like, what do we learn about God? I really think people had a feeling, they had a sense, and there were experiences, and they, you know, if I go back to the thing about Karl Barth, where he said that Christianity isn't a religion, it's more like a revelation about reality. And then, you know, some of that stuff I think is true. I think that Abraham's experience, I think in some night, I mean, who's going to verify what Abraham had to say? Like, who's going to be like, oh, Abraham, let me talk to you a little bit more about that promise God made to you when you were standing outside taking a leak.
We don't have like cell phone footage of Abraham and Jesus.
Well, and I think I'd be, you know, for instance, I'd be really, really disappointed if someone proved the existence of God. I think that would be the lamest thing that would ever happen in all of human intellect. Like, I don't think that's what God is. God, well,
what
do you know?
Think? Well, what if you had to say, gun held to your head right now, what would you say God is?
God. Like, I wouldn't, like, there's no predicate of that sentence that makes sense.
I know, that's why I'm asking.
So the thing is, like, God is beyond our knowing, you know? Like, we have a revelation for us, like, we have an experience in Jesus that people say, and they point to that and say, look, this is the way that God chose to be revealed, like, this man who died on a cross for others. Like, this teacher who taught, and then for what he taught was killed. Like, that's, if God, that's what God wants us to look at and understand. And so that's what we do. And that's a mystery. And, like, the thing that God is a continually unveiling mystery. And we get to just be part of that party, you know? But I think that's what makes us, like, the morality is always second to that, you know, to whatever that revelation is. That's what I. So if someone's held a gun to my head and said, like, what would you say? I'd probably, like, pee my pants or something like that. But
I heard a really great analogy. They were talking about like asking, like you have five blind men in the room,
yeah,
and they're all surrounding an elephant.
Yeah, the elephant in the room. Yeah.
Yeah, like tell me what the elephant's like. What does an elephant look like?
Oh, it's got a big leg. Oh, it's got this malleable like.
Right. And it's like everybody's just got their hand on one part, right. And I feel like that's.
Yeah.
Just even 2,000 years ago, they were holding their hand on one part of the elephant, right. And they aren't aware that there's this huge, massive thing. And the more I read science, the more I read about astrophysics and just the stuff going on out in the universe, and just little tiny things that there's no place in the known universe that doesn't have the same elements that exist here on Earth. Which I don't know what that leads me to believe. I don't know like why that's the case or what is the purpose of that, other than I've got to just be okay with the idea that I might just have my hand, like Earth is one part of the elephant,
right?
And we only have our hand on it, and this idea that we are the center of everything. I don't think that we're not a special thing. I think what's special about us is that we're able to, like, we are fortunate enough to evolve to be able to think about this stuff,
right?
I'm pretty sure my dog Sasha, and certainly not Anya, I'm pretty sure they don't think about this stuff, at least as far as I can perceive.
Right.
They're conscious. I think they're aware that they're alive. They're aware of pain. They are aware. They're able to empathize with. They
probably feel things about you, I bet.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. And they're aware when somebody's upset. Like, they're conscious in a very similar way to us in many ways. But I don't think their brains are able to think outside of. Like, their hand is only on the little, on the house, inside a neighborhood, inside on the Earth, you know? And so it's all relative to some point as to what you can comment on. And when I see people who are, I'm very skeptical of, and I don't mean this about you, because I don't think you actually carry yourself in this way, but I'm very skeptical, or I sort of like look out of the side of my eye with people who are so sure. And I'm not saying, or just so sure that they're right.
Yeah.
Like, I think you can be, I sense that you're confident in your belief, but I don't get the sense that you're right. Like, I don't get the sense that that's what you're sitting here feeling like, he'll figure it out. Like,
no, I don't feel like that's what my job is.
But that feels like that sometimes, I think that's why religion gets if religion gets a bad name, it's because of the people who think they're right.
See, I think the job, so if you think of me as a preacher, my job is to deliver a message. My job isn't to get you to agree with what I think. My job is I'm a herald. I'm a servant. You know, someone's given me something to share, and that's what I share, because I serve something else. My uncle, who's also a pastor, so there, when I was ordained, I was the sixth living pastor in my family. But he said to me one time when we were in a car,
you're like the Peyton and his Eli brother. It was brother Eli Manning.
Yeah.
Long lineage.
With fewer concussions, I hope.
Maybe a little less money than they have. Far fewer Super Bowl rings.
But we have a lot of vertebrae in our necks, so that's good. That's true. They have 3 Super Bowl rings, I guess. So he told me once, he said, you know, in order to do this job, you really got to love Jesus. He said, more than the people, you got to love Jesus. And that stuck with me a lot, because that means that I have, it's like a duty, like a mission. It's like a job, it's an assignment, whatever you want to call it, to tell people about him. And, you know, it's not my, I don't feel like it's my right to tell people that they have to think every single thing I think about Jesus. But it's my job to point to him, you know? Cause in the end it's like, if I'm right about God, if I'm right about anything, then like, you know, I think Paul, when he wrote in his letter, is right. Like, we don't see everything clearly now. We see in a glass half dark, I think is what he says. But, you know, but at the end we'll see God face to face, and then we'll know God perfectly. We don't now.
Yeah.
And it's important to know that, and it's important to say that God, because then you start doing it. It's the same. This is why I don't like proving God, you know, because then you've mastered God somehow. You know, like, you've like put God in a box, and that's just, you open the box, you won't find anything there. You know,
this has been the frustration with me with, like, when people discount science on. Yes.
New York City, baby.
It's God telling us to move closer to the mic.
Right.
science.
This is ASMR.
That's right. I hope you're feeling tingly out there, everybody.
Yes, can you hear me? I have... It's what frustrates me so much about people who think they're right.
Yeah.
That they are unable to conceive of... It's like, okay, if you think you know God, mm-hmm. and God is literally the most omnipotent thing ever, tell me about quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
And they can't. And you're like,
okay.
That's a pretty big concept. The idea that there's a molecule in Illinois right now that is the exact same one as sitting right here in New York.
Right.
That happens.
That's right.
So tell me about it if you think you're right.
You know, the best thing I've heard about this is, you know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer is?
I know the name, but could you... Stephanie talks about him.
I always call him the patron saint of Lutheran sermon illustrations.
Why do you say that?
Because he was a martyr.
Uh-huh.
And so, like...
He was killed by the Nazis.
Is correct, yeah, because he was plotting to kill Hitler.
That'll do it.
Yeah, it's part of his session.
Less than the fact that he was Lutheran, more he's trying to kill the...
Well, we claim him because he was Lutheran, and, you know, we don't have a lot of cool dudes like him.
Right.
Lutherans in general have been very...
How close did he get?
Pretty close. What happened was, the problem with this, I feel very nervous about saying things because this is recorded.
Was he going to poison Hitler with a potluck dinner?
They tried to bomb him.
With a potluck dinner?
I don't know if it was it wasn't a potluck dinner. It was like
that's a Lutheran thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. They should invite him to a potluck, you know. Here, Hitler, have this sauerkraut. It's tasty. You know, but no, this guy actually brought a bomb to... The reason why they caught the group was because this guy, I believe this is what happened. A guy brought a bomb to a meeting, and he put the bomb... Everything went correct. He put the bomb under the table, and it went off. But the table, they didn't count on how thick the table was. And the thickness of the table prevented Hitler from being killed.
Never underestimate German engineering.
That's right. Even if you're German.
Was this the thing that Valkyrie, that Tom Cruise...
I think it had something to do with that.
I don't know if Bonhoeffer was involved with that.
Yeah, he was involved in the assassination plot that was foiled somehow.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, and he was a double agent in the whole war. I mean, he wasn't like that good at it. I mean, he wasn't...
Clearly, he got...
He was really more like... His role actually was really more as a pastor to the to the conspirators. Mm. And like, because like, they had all these crises of conscience. Yeah, and they were good Germans. They wanted to be loyal to Germany, and they were wondering if they're engaging in murder.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Bonhoeffer said, yeah, it's a sin to murder somebody, but it's also a sin to, like, what's going on? So and we have to stop it.
I mean, I think when you think... I mean, we've talked about, and maybe will in a bit, about just the heat that it feels like we're in now. Like, the crucible it feels like right now, politically, socially, not all this. Like, at the time, it's hard. I mean, I try to empathize a little bit with those guys. And not just assume, they're all complicit, because it's like, well, I mean, when you're in it, it doesn't feel exactly the same way as it does 100 years later, where you're looking back and being like, those people were savages. It's like, these were dudes who...
Yeah, they're like us.
They were actually conflicted as to whether or not to take out Hitler. Now, we would look and be like, of course.
And of course, you take him out.
But good people were conflicted, and so that you got to take that.
Right.
There's some credence there.
And also, I think what we also discount is that normal people thought that what was happening was good.
Mm-hmm.
Just like today.
Yeah. Do you think as many people today think it was good as many people thought back then?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think, again, like you said, like, we'll understand more. To record another spiritual, like, we'll look back and wonder how we got over.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to happen now, too. I hope. Otherwise, we'll be dead.
Well, you mentioned in the beginning that...
Can I just say this thing about... I want to get back to whatever you... But so Bonhoeffer's thing about science,
mm-hmm.
and he was into science. Because his dad was a really famous psychiatrist.
Mm.
He was one of these guys who was like, Freud, not so much. It's more about your brain chemistry. And so his dad was doing that a lot. And so he grew up in this very, you know... when he told his parents he wanted to be a theologian, they're like, we hope you grow out of that. You know, it was a little bit of a scandal in his family. I mean, it was fine, but they let him do it. But but he said that you shouldn't look for, like, God shouldn't be explaining the gaps, right? So you shouldn't be like, well, because science can explain thing X, therefore that must be a God thing. Because science is going to explain that,
mm-hmm.
right? So he said, you look for God in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So you look for God in quantum whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not I suck at science. You know, I don't know much about it. I know a little bit about climate science, but that's about it. But I think that the real Christian way of approaching it is saying, whoa, look at this amazing evolutionary tree of life. God's in there somewhere.
Totally.
You know, and that's the way to think about it. Not like,
if you think that God is so rad.
Yeah.
But then you're like, but Jesus rode a dinosaur.
That's...
Evolution is kind of the raddest thing in the world. And evolution only survives on mistakes, which is literally what we as humans...
Yeah, we're good at that.
Sin is the sort of, like, almost every religion... is there a religion that starts off with, like, we're perfect, so just come hang out on Sundays?
I'm honestly not good at other religions either, but I also want to say sin's not a mistake.
Well,
sin's not a mistake. Sin is intentional.
Well, neither is being born with, like, being born a saber-toothed tiger with no front teeth. Like, that's not a sin.
That's not a sin.
But it's an evolutionary
adaptation
or something that gets, like, just doesn't survive.
Yeah.
And that's, like, we've gotten here by realizing that murder is something that's not going to be in our evolutionary best interest. I mean, I don't know. There's some days I feel like, I don't know, if I could take a few people out today, the world might be a better
A little point. Bit of capital punishment never hurt a society. Right? Is that what you... No, I don't know.
I don't believe that. I mean, that's my irrational lizard brain that talks when I'm behind the wheel of my car. Right. But...
Yeah. Especially in Washington Heights.
But it's... I mean, we view ourselves as fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
As the sort of crux of our religious beliefs, and evolution is built off of fundamental flaws. It exploits and cleaves off the flaws, and then it grows, and then the environment changes, and a new flaw is exploited that wasn't a flaw 300 years ago. So the idea that you wouldn't think, like, if God invented all this stuff, that you wouldn't think that God also is like, I don't know, stuff might not be the same now. It might change later, so we're going to build this into the system.
I often feel it has this idea of control. Like, I think it's about this idea, like, of a feeling to need to explain everything, rather than encountering God as a mystery.
But you can explain evolution. That's the thing.
Well, you don't have to explain
the way to faith. You can say, like, well, there's a boundary line here where the comet hit.
Yeah.
And nothing below it survived. Have you seen the Ken Ham debates with, do you know who Ken Ham is? He's the guy that built the creationism museum.
Why would I watch that, though? I have a limited life.
Well, I was just nights when your blood pressure's real low. And you're like, I would love it to spike.
Yeah.
Turn on this Ken Ham debate. Because that's...
I got kids, man. I don't need to...
But it's fascinating because Bill Nye, the science guy... He gets up... Bill. he gets up and debates. And he just keeps saying, like, you're entitled to your opinion, Mr. Ham, but I would love to prove... I would love to back up your theory that Jesus rode a dinosaur. Unfortunately, we have no bones of dinosaurs in the same geological record as the time when Jesus rode.
Does that guy actually think that Jesus rode a dinosaur?
I don't know. I mean, do people actually believe that gay people burn in hell?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, then people believe Jesus rides a dinosaur. I mean, to me, that's just an irrational belief as... like protesting a gay soldier's funeral because their whole life was illegitimate.
Yeah.
Like the Westboro Baptist Church.
It's those guys.
But, well, you know,
we have a religion based on this idea that guy rose from the dead. That doesn't happen.
No.
Right. That's against the laws.
It's never happened as far as we know.
Yeah.
except for one time. But
I believe that. I believe that happened.
I wish there was like some 9-year-old kid with a cell phone camera at the tomb when it rolled open.
Yeah, it's like hashtag resurrection.
TMZ
hashtag
woke. TMZ gets a hold of that footage and it's all out.
Yeah, it's like troublesome Rabbi Jesus rises from the tomb. Mitch McConnell. Not happy.
Far left demagogue rises from the tomb.
We don't approve of this resurrection, and we're not going to allow that to come to the floor. Yeah,
but that would be even kind of a bummer if we knew.
It would suck
because everybody, like the Muslims, the Jews, everybody have to be like,
Yeah, exactly. Or I mean,
fake news.
I just don't like the idea of proven stuff.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything in scripture that like there's a great line. Well, maybe it's not in that book. There's this great book called Gilead. Have you ever read Gilead? Marilynne Robinson? So Gilead's a great book, I think. And this is a Calvinist preacher in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's basically an old preacher.
What is a Calvinist?
Calvinist is a guy... Well, I guess he's technically Congregationalist. But a Calvinist is someone who follows the teachings of John Calvin.
And how do those... I'm asking... I know who John Calvin is, but I'm asking out of ignorance. Like, what is the difference between John Calvin and Luther? Other than the different... Luther had a pretty terrible haircut.
Boy, if you asked me this 10 years ago, I could do a much better answer than now. But, you know, John Calvin was more into God's sovereignty and the majesty and beauty of God, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Luther was really about God getting in the muck with you and suffering with you. Yeah. And so the typical, there's a guy named Paul Santmeyer that writes about how Lutheran theology is a theology of descent, mm-hmm. not ascent. Mm-hmm. So that God is always coming down to us, mm-hmm. not, and then I guess Calvin might be more of God's lifting us up, you know.
Got it.
But in a lot of ways, they're very similar. They had a lot of fights, especially around the Eucharist and stuff like that. But anyway, so this novel's about this preacher, and you know, Luther and Calvin are both what you would call that. There's this conversation about predestination. Predestination is God knows who's going to hell and who's not, and has just chosen ahead of time who's going to hell and who's going to heaven. Mm-hmm. But it's this big mystery, and Luther. One of the things that Luther, he just refused to talk about that. He's like, that's just not like God clearly knows and is omniscient, is all powerful, but it's not my job. It's like not my job to decide who's going to hell or not. Hmm. Like, and it's not my job to ask, because my job is to offer hope in these promises that God has. Hmm. So they fight about that a little bit. But anyway, and there's this conversation in the novel about this. It's actually a good novel, even though it has a conversation about predestination. Everybody should read it. But there's this line where it says that you can't say anything good about God from a position of defense. Hmm. Like, and for me, that also means like, you shouldn't try to prove God. Like the way that people love God seems to me to be that it's when they encounter God's love in whatever mm-hmm. way that is. Mm-hmm. And so they connect to that and they say, wow, I am loved by something that is beyond my ability to know and understand. And that's what I want to learn more about.
What would you say?
How did I get on that? I'm sorry. That's,
well, I asked you about it.
Okay, sorry.
You mentioned Calvinist, and I wanted to clarify. What I get asked a lot, like, well, what is a Lutheran? What's the difference? Because they asked me, like, what I was raised, and I was raised Catholic.
Right.
And they're like, well, what's the difference? And I try to give them the nickel and dime tour that I think is appropriate. But what would you say is somebody walks into a Catholic church one Sunday and then walks into a Lutheran church the next Sunday, what are the major differences that they're going to see?
You wouldn't see, like, on a typical Lutheran church and a typical Catholic church, you wouldn't see a difference between the Mass. Like, the Mass would feel very similar. There's the slight wording changes here and there. Except I think one thing that's a little important is that we don't believe in transubstantiation, meaning that we don't believe that the bread and the wine have been changed into the body and blood of Christ. Mm-hmm. We believe that because Christ has ascended to the right hand of the Father, you know, God is everywhere. So therefore, Christ, in some sense, must be everywhere. That Christ is what we call in with and under the bread and the wine, so mm-hmm. that it becomes the body and blood of Christ. Not because it never was, in a sense, but because God has somehow brought us our attention to that and makes a promise that Christ is going to be there. Mm-hmm. So there's no, like, change affected. It's just, like, a focusing.
It's more of a symbol than than a real, like,
it's like
literal.
You know, it's really there. Christ is really, it's really his body and blood, but it's more like the word that I like to say is that it's a consecration. Mm. You know, it's a drawing of attention to a promise of God that's been attached to something. Mm. So, like, if you were to say, well, it's like a love, like, think about like a gift you give, say like an engagement ring. Mm-hmm. And the engagement ring is like, you're the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, and I'm promising you that I'm doing that. And that's what the bread and the wine is, basically God's engagement. It's like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that, like, you know, the ring doesn't stop being like a hunk of metal and a rock, but it has meaning because of the promise that's attached to it. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with the bread and the wine. And because Christ, you know, as Luther says, Christ is fully, God and God are fully present even in the tiniest tree leaf. So that the entirety of God is present for you in this tiny tree leaf, just like God is fully present but not comprehended by the world. Mm-hmm. That's like a paradox idea. That's why Christ is present in the bread and the wine. It's mm-hmm. because wherever God is, Christ is fully present and there for us in that.
So
that's a very technical description. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would say is the hierarchy. You know, we have the Catholics have a hierarchy. It's a global hierarchy that's, you know, in some ways really amazing. And, you know, they're able to do things, for instance, with the poor that Lutherans can't. Like they can go to any country in any place in any world and send a priest there. Mm-hmm. And the priest is going to live on next to nothing. Like when we were in Tanzania, we met a priest and a bunch of nuns from, they were actually stationed in, they're Guatemalan, and they were working up in northern Kenya. And all I have in northern Kenya really is like, you know, there's not much there. Mm-hmm. Like there's some AK-47s, and like that was a problem for them. They had to figure out how to deal with that. But, you know, there's not much there, but they had the Catholic Church was there, you know, dealing with extreme poverty, drought, and they were there, you know, so like that's, and that's kind of a, they're able to do that in ways that our church can't, because our clergy are married and they have, they're trying to raise families. And so we can't take those kind of risks sometimes.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah.
Just there's less freedom with the, the foot soldiers.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there's a problem with the hierarchy too, with all the secrecy and the, you know, all that stuff. But, and the Catholic Church, of course, is the biggest religious body in the world. But so that's, I think, the two main differences that I
see. Have Catholics outnumbered Muslims in the world?
Yes.
By population? Yes. They still do?
I believe so.
By how much?
I mean, not a lot, but there's like over a billion Catholics.
Okay.
It's not a lot, but it's, yeah.
And
I believe, you know, again, this is weird. I feel like I have to like Google everything.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm not a historian.
I know that they're the biggest religious group, I guess.
Okay. Well, what, I mean, I also, the most glaring obvious thing to me, and this is maybe burned into my brain from a kid, from being a kid in a Lutheran or a Catholic church, is there's no, Jesus isn't hanging there. Like,
it depends on the Lutheran church you go to.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because everyone I've been to has just been a cross.
A bare cross, yeah.
And the Catholic church I grew up in, St. Joseph's in Dover, Ohio, was like...
Shout out.
Shout out, St. Joseph's was, you know, Jesus crucified.
Big bloody Jesus.
Big bloody Jesus. Yeah. Abs for days.
Ripped abs, yeah.
Big old sword wound in the side wound, and blood leaking down.
Yeah,
and
water, this look of
horror,
water,
horror on his face and crown of thorns. I mean, it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And I feel like since... Like, to me, that's like, that sets the stage. It's like when somebody walks into a concert hall to see Soul Percussion, if they just see...
Over to see blood.
No. Well, but like, if you see an empty stage, you don't know what to expect. If you walk in, you see one flower pot or you see a cactus, there's a, you think different things. Yeah. And if the first thing, like, if the first thing that somebody saw when they walked into a Soul Percussion concert was a video playing of just like skateboarding accidents, people breaking their arms, like... It would reframe everything you said we played after that.
So what was your experience like going into the Lutheran church the first time? What was that like?
Well,
assume you went with Stephanie.
Into a Lutheran church? Yeah. Lutheran church? I think it was with Stephanie, yeah. It was, I want to say, like, I went in feeling like, you know, every time I went into church as a kid, I mean, whatever, I was a kid too, so it was like I was going because mom wanted me, you know, mom and dad made me go, and my grandmother was very, very Catholic, if there's such a thing as Catholic and then very Catholic. I would say it was more like, as a kid, I was in awe. Like, it was just sort of like the first feeling you get when you walk into like a baseball stadium for the first time or a big arena. You're just sort of like, what is this crazy stuff? And there's all these stations and there's other people who kind of, some people look happy, some people look miserable, some people are holding children, and you're looking around all these things, everybody's lighting candles, and there's a huge organ.
Yeah.
Like, wow, this is crazy. And then there's this guy hanging there and you don't really know why, but it's kind of awesome because you're a boy and you love gory shit.
Like, That's awesome. Like, church should be kind of cool like that.
It was kind of cool, but as I got, you know, as you get more steeped in what the hierarchy is and the sort of process you go through as a, you know, going through ecumenical school or catechism or whatever it was called. Not ecumenical. What is that?
Ecumenical is a bunch of churches working together.
Definitely not what I went through.
That's right.
Catechism, right? Was that, is that,
would
that
catechism, be? Yeah. CCD.
Sunday school, CCD. Then it's like, then they start to tell you like, oh, this crazy thing you've been seeing for the last years, this is why you should be afraid of it, and this is why you should this is why you should confess all your sins, because this guy, that guy right there, he's hanging like that because you stole a bunch of tennis balls from the high school tennis team. And I'm like,
wait a minute,
seems totally nutso to me, but I guess I'll confess. My bad, I stole the tennis balls. I hope he's okay. Going to a Lutheran church, it was not that the pressure was off, it just felt like I could take in the raw material better, because I wasn't having to see it through these, I wasn't distracted by all these other crazy things that to me felt very distant from everybody was talking about. We got to love each other. You got to take care of your neighbor. Let's, you know, be a good Samaritan. Let's, like, all the platitudes that you hear, but then I'm looking up and there's a guy hanging there, and all the past priests are telling me that I'm a bad person. I'm like, well, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't connect the two.
Yeah.
And going to church, I was older too, going to church with Stephanie, so I was more mature, but it just feels to me like I'm able to sort of process the information purer to me. I'm sure there's Catholics out there pissed off that I'm saying that, but for me, that was Catholicism light is the wrong word. That's an insult, I think. But it is all the stuff that Martin Luther thought was BS about the Catholics. And I'm just like, yep, well, yeah, got a point. You know, take away the Virgin Mary. I mean, she's rad, but like, we don't need to worship her anymore.
Right.
Take away the scary dead guy. Take away the guilt, and take away this idea that you've got to just fess up to everything you've done all the time. We're going to start from that place of grace.
Right.
We're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And as long as you're, like, just don't be an ass.
Right.
You know, that's, well, like, if the Bible could be a post-it note, just like,
don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole. Yeah. Like, you don't have to love everybody, but you don't have to be an asshole either.
That's right.
You could just be a person in the world. And
you could be a person. I think Luther, like, you know, as I had this crusty, wonderful teacher of Lutheran theology at the University of Chicago named Susan Schreiner. She's retiring this year, but she came into class the first day, and she looks around and says, oh, all of you think you're pretty good people, right? And we're all like, yeah. She goes, like, not in the 16th century. She's like, in order to see God, you have to be perfect. Otherwise, you die. It's just like, and you're not perfect.
So yeah, that's Galileo just had the random thought that perhaps the sun revolved around, or the earth revolved around the sun, not the other way around. Everybody flipped out and killed him. So
I'm a big believer in the fallenness of humanity and, you know, the atonement and all that bloody, gory stuff. But I just think there's a different way of talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think, like, you need to tell a 10-year-old, you know, you stole tennis balls, that's why Jesus is hanging on the cross for you. I mean, that's, you know, you might not be ready for that at 10, you know?
I mean, as a 39-year-old, I understand. I mean, I don't think that my priest was a bad person.
Yeah.
I think I get where, I understand the intent.
Yeah.
I understand that you're trying to build into people a morality structure of, like, it's bad to steal. Like, let's not steal.
Yeah.
And here's why. Because other people, those are people's possessions, and they're going to spend time wondering where they are. Like, you're going to waste their time. You're wasting their money. You've taken something from them.
Yeah.
And you haven't given them anything back.
Yeah, you've hurt them.
Right. Those are real consequences, but that does not mean, like, I didn't. Yeah, that guy hanging there has nothing to do.
Where does that guy come in?
I understand the intent. It's the delivery and the sort of the way they make you deal with it that is a little troublesome.
And I have I don't know. I'm not a Catholic, clearly. But I definitely have some issues. But I also respect the heck out of the Catholic Church too for a lot of reasons. And a lot of it is because they're right there with the poor everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to the most godforsaken place in the world where there's just nothing but horror, there's gonna be, like, the Catholic Church is gonna be there,
and they're usually the first on the ground when there's an earthquake in Haiti. It's not the Red Cross. Well, I mean, I was talking to my ass. The Red Cross does great work,
yeah,
I think,
they, but, like, they do. A lot of people do,
but the Catholic Church, because of their nimbleness and their worldwide sort of presence, they're able to be there.
And there's all kinds of people in the Catholic, like, it's funny, you know, we're going through this horrible thing right now in Protestantism. They call it the Big Sort.
The Big Sort?
Yeah, where, like, it used to be the people's religious beliefs determined their political views. Mm-hmm. Now people's political views are determining their religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. So people are leaving churches in order to find other churches that match their political beliefs.
That happened?
Yeah.
Did that happen to you at all in the election?
I got a little more radicalized. I got a lot more radicalized because of the election.
I mean, did you lose parishioners over that sort
Not
of thing?
In this parish, no. Okay, all right. Not, but everybody else, almost, not in Manhattan. I'd probably lose parishioners if I didn't get a little angry from the pulpit about what's going on in this stupid country right now. But, you know, we became a sanctuary church, all this other stuff. But anyway, so that's a bit of a problem. And the Catholic Church, as I understand it, the Big Sort still happens. I mean, people are looking for conservative parishes versus liberal. But the Catholic Church is still one of the few places where people of every political stripe, from, like, your crazy hardcore Marxists to your crazy hardcore libertarians, can conceivably come and worship together in the same building.
Do you think that has anything to do with the idea that I think fundamentally people, I agree with you in some sense that people have the potential to be horrifyingly bad all the time.
Yeah.
Me and you included.
Yep.
The things I say, I've said it a million times on the podcast, like the things I say behind the wheel of my car to seemingly lovely people.
Well, they don't seem so lovely, do they?
But the reality of the situation is, like, I was a racist right there.
Yeah.
Or I was a misogynist, or I was an ageist. Like, something happened that came out of my mouth. And I don't mean it, but I have the potential.
Oh, yeah. It's down there.
It's in there. And that can be kind of terrifying. And for me, the best way to sort of lasso that insanity inside of me is structure. Yeah. And the one thing, like you said, the Catholic Church does really well. And religion, I think, by and large, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, there is a structure. Like, there's no religion. Buddhism, and I don't know shit about Buddhism, but what little I know, it seems enough sort of, they stripped away enough of as much of the structure as possible to where it can just barely stand up. It's like, I don't know, being human is innately shitty, so welcome to the club.
Right.
And if you can accept that, then you're going to be fine. But that's still a structure.
Yeah.
And there's still the Dalai Lama, whether or not he's not treated like the bishop or the pope, but there's still a leader. There's still somebody sitting at the top.
Well, he's one of them, right? Aren't there? That's like Tibetan Buddhism, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like there's different Buddhisms.
But in every major religion, there is some version of a hierarchy, some structure, because without it, human beings, we resort to our worst.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah, we become, it's a lot weaker. We become a lot weaker in a lot of ways. And I think that goes back to that thing we were talking about earlier. We got to kill that alpha male, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But one thing, I read your, like your introduction on your website, because I was doing a little research. I was like,
which introduction? The one
that took you like 6 months to write or whatever it was about, you had the sweet baby Jesus and then Jon Snow and everything else.
Yeah.
I like the way you spelled Jon Snow. That was
I spelled it wrong, on purpose.
Cool. Yeah, several times.
Yeah. Just to piss Stephanie off.
But one thing about that, I think it was really true.
You're talking about the concert honesty.
So everybody should read it. The thing I liked about it was this: the part where you're talking about if someone asks for help, you give them help, and if you need help, you ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's because you've developed a relationship with somebody.
Mm.
And the thing that I preach a lot about this is, you know, one of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's things was if you have an enemy, you should pray for that person.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you pray for people, they stop being your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that in a church, I believe that one of the most amazing things is we pass the peace.
Mm-hmm.
And we always do it in our tradition before communion as sort of a symbolic way of saying, I'm forgiving you and I'm asking you to forgive me for anything that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And for like a little moment at communion, whatever, when, you know, just that one little moment would last, 5 minutes maybe.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff is put aside for something much bigger than whatever it is. And I think that it's that relationship that you're making. You're looking at somebody who's a real person and seeing them for a real person, you know, and that changes everything. I think,
it's one of the things that when I hear Sam Harris talk about religion, he's very quick to discount the dogmatic parts of it, which again, I understand where he's coming from.
Right.
I can understand why somebody would think like, you know, why am I up here just saying back the same things to the pastor? Like, what is that doing for me? I can be a good person without this.
Yeah.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But the one thing you're discounting is like, are you actually going to get up off the couch and go spend time with a body of people that you don't really know all that well, just for the hell of it? Probably not.
I mean, do meetups still happen? Yeah, I don't know.
We're having a meetup now,
but we're friends.
Yeah. But it's like it takes work to meet up one on one.
Yeah,
and you know we had a meetup scheduled the other night, and we had to bail on it because of a bunch of other stuff. It's like it's hard.
Yeah,
but the one thing the church does is make it easy.
Yeah,
we're having a party every Sunday. I'm gonna dance for you for an hour during the service. We're gonna have coffee and cookies, and I'm gonna make ready to
sermon. Gertrude's gonna bring her cake.
We're all gonna sing.
Yeah,
it's gonna be great.
Yeah, people sing in public in church.
Right. No one, like, there's a lot of things that go on in church that are sort of microcosms of the way I think we all used to operate prior to the internet, prior to cell phones, prior to all this stuff that we feel like we're communicating now. But
And I don't know what Sam Harris has to say about this, but the point of that isn't to make you a better person. It, like, being a better person is sort of like a side benefit.
Yeah. But it's like it's the thing that you can't. I mean, it's why people love like the human touch. Yeah. Stephanie and I were talking about this the other day.
That's a Bruce Springsteen album.
Yeah, well, and it came out of an argument for why prostitution should be legalized.
Uh-huh.
And it was a really good argument. I was like, wow. I mean, not that I don't have an agenda with prostitution one way or another, but the point was like, well, one of the things that human beings, babies from Crave. Right out of the womb, is human touch.
Yep.
And not even affection, just the acknowledgement that you're a person, like a pat on the back, a hug, a handshake, a kiss, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that if prostitution was legal, people who, for whatever reason, whether because they're very socially awkward, because they've got a physical disformity, they have, you know, they're somebody coming back from a war who had their face blown off and for some reason is not able to function in the society in the way that they used to or that they want to or that society expects of them, that if you could go pay to have human touch, the world might be a slightly better place. Sure. And like, whatever. I don't necessarily, I'm not advocating for that, but it got me thinking about this idea that like, church is not, you're not going to see a prostitute, but you're being around other people.
Yeah.
Who.
It's why it hurts when you're not acknowledged in a church.
Yeah.
Like, and so it's why it hurts when you show up to a church and no one says hello or welcome. I mean, some people, when they first show up to a church, don't want to be noticed. Like, it's like dating. Like, you don't really know, like, how to do the first
date. Sit in the back of the room. Yeah. Or you enter your first day of classes at college. Exactly. You're like, God, where am I going
to
sit?
Yeah, I don't want to sit by that person. Damn it, that person sat next to me. You know,
I don't want to sit in the front row because I was going to think I'm a nerd. Yeah. But that's where I'm going to get the best grades.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, all that stuff goes into play.
But it hurts when no one says hello or acknowledges you or, like, he in that kind of thing. Because, like, it is supposed to be like that in a church.
I have found... what time do you need to...
Nothing, I just got to...
Oh, okay. I work a lot in Caribbean communities in Brooklyn, and one of the things that I would say is consistent, it's a bit of a, I mean, I'm painting with a broad brush here, of course, but their culture is very acknowledgement-based. Anybody walks into a room, they say, if it's in the evening, they say, good night, good night.
Yeah.
They say hello, good morning.
Yeah, same thing in Argentina too. Like, you
the
had to
whole
say
room it. Responds. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't matter if it's a classroom, a church, whatever. Everybody responds.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a friend of mine is a former student. Kendall mentioned that when he first started taking classes, I think it was at Princeton, that he shows up and he's maybe one of the only African American kids in the room.
Yeah.
He walks in the room and he says, you know, good afternoon, and no one says a peep. And he said it was just really off-putting, and he's like, I know that they're not mad at me and they think I'm a bad person, but culturally where I come from,
that's just
you
rude.
Acknowledge the other person when they come in the room, that's you right. know, that's a thing. And it's always like that kind of stuck with me, just this idea. And I feel like church in the way that you recite things back, like it's just an acknowledgement. It's not necessarily like you don't even have to be invested in what the pastor said, but just the bare minimum of being like, may the Lord be with you. Like, at least you acknowledged that something
that's
was said to you.
That's the whole point. When he said, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, love God, and the Holy Spirit be with you all, and also with you, that's like, it's the greeting. And it's and everybody needs to be included in that. And that's what good liturgy does. The liturgy literally means, or maybe it doesn't literally mean this, but it's the work of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing this together. It's not just me chancel prancing or whatever it is. But like,
I like that word, chancel prancing.
But it's like the whole, you know, it's the work of the whole community. And the more the community does the work, the better.
Well, where do you, in the current times, we sort of danced around the political issues going on right now, like, what do you see the role of the church?
First is truth.
In all of this.
Truth. Mm. You know, to say that there is truth. Truth is, there's truth. And we can know some truth.
Mm-hmm.
And because the first thing totalitarians do is, like, disrupt the idea of truth.
Who does?
Totalitarians. Like, it's the classic first move, is that you know, like... Part of the problem with Trump is that he just lies constantly in order to see how far he can go, because he doesn't care about the truth. He doesn't care about and if for society to work, there has to be some sort of agreement on truth, that there are lines, that there's things that we are facts. This is why climate change is such a problem, is because there's a whole entire portion of our population that's trying to undermine the idea of the scientific consensus and all this stuff. But so the first thing the church has to do, I think, in this time is really reclaim the idea that there's some things are true, and one of that is that God loves you, and that nothing changes that. God loves you, and that and if you believe that and you think that's true, that opens the world for you in a way that, like, the way that I think Trump's trying to shape the world actually closes the world down. So that's the first. That's the very first thing I think the church has to... We kind of got away from that, like, in the 90s and 2000s, where, you know, all this stuff about, you know, I don't know what. I mean, we just have to have some courage and just say, there's some true shit.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some of it, and we're going to tell you what it is. And one of it is God loves you, and God loves that frickin', you know, illegal immigrant from Guatemala who is being burned out of their home because it's too hot to grow crops there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and God loves that person, and so I have to, too.
Right.
You know,
there's incredible drug crime that's pushing them north.
Yeah, or there's
through Mexico into the United States,
which is partially our fault.
Right.
You know, and we need
pulled to, all of our aid out of there, which isn't helping the cause.
Which isn't helping, and you know, and all that. We need to say that stuff. Mm-hmm. We need to say things like, you know, you want to be a Christian, then you first have to believe that every single person on this earth belongs to God and not to a flag. Mm-hmm. Like, it's good to have a nation. It's good to have structure. It's good to have laws. And there are certainly nations I'd rather be living in than others. Mm-hmm. The United States is, I love this country very much. But as a Christian, God doesn't love me more because I'm an American. Mm-hmm. You know, God just doesn't really care about that. That's something that we've had to work out for ourselves, and God allows to happen so that we can have some kind of order, you know, and to have the rule of law, which is helpful for us.
But we're back-to-back world champion, World War champions, John.
That's right. Well, you know.
Yeah. How could God not love us the most?
Well, that's right. I mean,
we've won two world wars.
That's right.
We're going to start a third.
God forbid. I mean, let's look at that for a little bit. Why did we win World War II? It's because we had this guy named FDR. I think there's a real thing about this. Like, we had this guy. We were lucky. We could have gone down the route of Germany. You know, and it's funny. And you know, I lived in Argentina. Perón and FDR came to power about the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think economically speaking, Argentina and the United States were about on equal footing. Mm-hmm. They had similar histories, mm-hmm. A lot of similarities. And the difference between us and Argentina, one of the big differences, and I'm not like a South American comparative constitutional scholar or anything like that, so all caveats apply, but we got FDR, who really, really cared about the future of the poor, but also in a way that was democratic. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, he wasn't perfect, and there's a lot of politics, but we were lucky that mm-hmm. we got him, and that our institutions were preserved, and that the rule of law was preserved, and you know, and I think that's under, like, we also had, somehow we're able to make friends with Stalin for a little bit, and he like took the brunt of their German army and stuff like that. But you know, when you look around the world now, like, the idea that democracy can work, and it's based on reason and the understanding of real threats, real opportunities, real truths, and that we can treat one another with respect, like, that stuff works. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's one of the reasons why we haven't had another world war, is because of, you know, like, multilateral agreements, like the idea that we're going to engage in other countries. I mean, we're going to work with other countries to lift everybody out of poverty as best we can. I mean, none of it's at all perfect, but like, I really believe that kind of stuff really matters. And I think, you know, it's funny, in the 50s, the ecumenical movement, to go back to that word, started mm-hmm. with Pope John the 23rd with Vatican II. And I think Protestants discount about how important that movement was for us. And because Protestants got to go to Vatican II and sit outside and listen and mm-hmm. talk to the people making decisions and stuff, and that affected us, because then we went back to our churches and said, you know, we're one church, we gotta unite around one thing. And so you know, it gave us a more global perspective of who we are and what our purpose was as a church. Mm-hmm. So I think all that stuff runs a lot counter to everything that's being spouted. You know, and I think the other thing too is just to act by loving people, and to tell people that it's not okay. It's not okay to say that, you know, Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers and mm-hmm. they're not the best or whatever. I don't, you know, all that stuff. I get really worked up. Like, I get really mad when I hear about, you know, the evangelical, quote unquote, and it's not even all evangelicals, it's just the loud ones supporting Trump. Because, you know, they make comparisons to David, you know, and other people like this. Well, David was a sinner. Yeah, but you know, David like groveled before God because he realized he was a sinner. You know, he changed because of his actions, and he's actually a tragic story. Like, you look at the end of David's life, there's two different tales of David in the Bible. One is like, you know, he kind of died and then Solomon became. The other was like, David suffered at the end of his life and he had a horrible thing with Absalom, and it was tragic, and he died grieving and old and frail and shivering on his bed, you know. And so I just feel like all that stuff has to be talked about, you know.
Well, what?
Sorry, I got a little.
No, that's fine. I mean, I feel like there's one of the roles I think of the church, and when I think of the church, I think of the people I know in the church, like you and Stephanie and Kim and whoever else she, you know, the, all the people, folks at Pinecrest, like right. all this stuff that, but when I think the church is talked about on Fox News or MSNBC or in the New York Times, that's not who they're talking about.
Oh.
But my wager is that the vast majority of churches, when, if we were to look at the church, actually fall under your category, unless the you know, Reverend Al Sharpton's maybe a bad example, but just like the shiny, we're here, right. Prosperity Gospel.
Joel Osteen,
yeah. Kenneth Cope. I mean, Al Sharpton maybe isn't in that crew, but the showy church, like right. we're the church on TV and like all this stuff that I feel like they're winning the messaging battle.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I'm asking like, how do you win that back? I mean, I'll just say it. I think you've lost the messaging battle. Yeah. I think there's now a real argument for removing tax exempt status for churches from the government. It wouldn't surprise me if Trump went that route, but there's enough argument coming from the left.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of that is like sort of vaguely concealed anti-religious hatred.
It is, honestly. But it comes from people like Kenneth Copeland because yeah. they, like, somebody on the, I mean, Joe Rogan was just talking about it.
Yeah.
He's totally for removing, and this is where he and I don't agree.
Yeah.
It's like, but when he says it out of, in relief well, to he, somebody like Kenneth yeah. Copeland
well,
or Joe
I think
Osteen.
Someone like Kenneth Copeland or somebody like that is clearly, well, I think.
But that's like saying Kenneth Copeland or Donald Trump is clearly not a Republican. It's like, yeah, he is.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
baby. Well, I'm going to retract what I kind of said. I think it's really important that you don't, you know, religion has a protected status in the United States for, I think, good reasons, mm-hmm. namely to allow people to express themselves in the way that they want to. And you know, the NFL is a not-for-profit, tax-exempt organization. Mm-hmm. Like, if anybody needs to be taxed, it's the NFL.
I know. So, it's the first thing anybody should say is, like, okay, so the New England Patriots shouldn't have to pay taxes.
Well, I think the New England Patriots might. The NFL, I mean, as a friend, I'm not sure how that works.
But
the NFL, I know. Like, the National Football League, whatever that structure is a not-for-profit organization.
Aren't the Green Bay Packers a non-profit?
Well, they're not. They're owned by whoever.
They're like a co-op.
Yeah.
By, like, they local are. Citizens yeah. in Green Bay. Or something, right?
Yeah, when I watch football, that was my team. So the messaging battle is, well, one way to argue that is that actually we won the messaging battle. We like completely, like, we have gay marriage. For a long time, like the Voting Rights Act before it was gutted was in place and was working. Mm-hmm. Integration was happening. It kind of stopped happening in the 80s, but it happened, and like there was all these culture warrior things. Abortion, you know, was allowed. Like, you know, mainline Protestantism won. Like we won that stuff. We won, you know, this idea of tolerance and diversity and all that stuff. That was all our bag, mm-hmm. and we won that stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So, but then what happened is we just, like, a lot of times when you get too big, you start failing. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't. So we used to have Reinhold Niebuhr used to be on the radio, and everybody would listen to Reinhold Niebuhr, the theologian from Union Theological Seminary, talk mm-hmm. about stuff. And his brother, H. Richard Niebuhr, like, they were on TV all the time. They're on the radio all the time talking about things. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, he was kind of like, we look at back on him better now than we did when he was first around. But those people were given a lot of time and airspace, and were listened to and changed things. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we won a lot of those battles. Now I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I don't. We got William Barber, who's awesome, but he can't, for whatever reason, he's just not treated the same by the media as you know, Jerry Falwell Jr. And I think part of the reason is, like, we forget how provocative Martin Luther King Jr. was. Like, we look at him now and we're like, oh, it was Martin Luther King Jr., he's a saint, all this stuff. We forget that people were really, really pissed off at him. Well, by people, I mean, like, white people. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a media culture that seems to understand that if you want advertising and you want revenue, then you have to have, like, really strong conflicting emotions. Mm-hmm. And the people that do that the best are these TV preacher types. Mm-hmm. So, and also, I think that we've done a really crappy job teaching our pastors how to talk about things like science. Mm-hmm. And we're no longer the best educated people in our towns. Like, when my great-great-great-grandfather showed up in, like, you know, the plains of Colorado, mm-hmm. like, he was a German-educated master's degree or whatever they had back then.
The first printed guy. Word was the Gutenberg Bible, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, like, and that's, pastors were where, like, right. The church leaders were who had the books.
That's right. And so
who could read?
Well, you know? And the whole point of the Reformation was that everybody could read that stuff, you know? Yeah. But the idea was, I think, so that, you know, my great-great-grandfather and the lawyer and the judge and the doctor were, like, the educated class of, like, these mm-hmm. itsy-bitsy little towns. And so, of course, people were like, well, you know, that guy knows what he's talking about. He went to school in Germany, yeah. you know? Yeah. And now that's just, I mean, like, what does a guy who's got, like, a PhD in my congregation need to hear me talk about crap? You know, I'm just a master's degree. And so I think there's a lot of things, but I agree that, like, after we won that, either we just got so complacent and just kind of assumed that everything was going to go great and we didn't really read the Bible particularly well. Because there's a thing the Bible's got to tell us is, like, you know, things don't go great. And these guys, these outliers, kind of came in and started taking over. But there's also a big plan. Like, there's a lot of money behind these people. And they also sort of, like, gotten into bed with. Have you ever read Dark Money? Mm-mm. Or Democracy in Chains or anything like that? Mm-mm. There's a big wedding between the prosperity gospel preachers and people who are exploiting the planet and other people for money. I mean, basically what they want to hear is that God sanctions their wealth and the way they got it.
Yeah.
And some people are very, very eager to say that to them, so they'll give them money. And other people want to be like them, so they want to hear that.
Yeah.
So I think that's a problem.
What would you say? I've kept you here for an hour and 22 minutes.
Sorry. Already.
No, no, no. It's fine. Time flies. You know, one of the things that's been most revealing to me about the, like, doing a podcast is that how little I actually talk to somebody without my phone.
Oh yeah.
You know, just for, you know, yeah. And an hour and a half will fly by.
Yeah. It's much better.
It's way better.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I had to text my wife.
You know? No, it's fine. I have one final question and it is, what would you say to somebody who, maybe is questioning religion, questioning coming to church, maybe doesn't want to come to church only because they're afraid they're going to get made fun of from yeah. their friends or,
oh yeah, that's
or they think it's bullshit.
Yeah.
What would you say to somebody who thinks the whole stuff, all of it's bullshit, but likes you as a person and is like, John, I got nothing to do on Sunday. Why should I come to church? And John, don't feed me this line of God is awesome. Because that doesn't resonate with me right now.
Right now, okay.
Why should I come on Sunday?
Why are you asking that question?
Just because my wife is a pastor, as you know, and yeah. I have a lot.
No, not you in the role. Like,
I have students who ask me this yeah. sort of thing all the yeah. time.
Well, that's what I would say to them.
And, like, I come across them, and I don't necessarily know what to tell them, because I don't want to speak for my wife. No,
that's what I'm saying. It's like, why are you asking? So I feel like that very question is like, well, why should I come to church? Or, you know, for mm-hmm. me, that means that you kind of want to.
Yep. But it's the same, like, when somebody's like, why should I come to a Soap Percussion show?
Yeah. Because you're, like, curious. Why not?
Yeah. But a Soap Percussion show doesn't necessarily give me insight onto the origins and the end of my life. Or the purpose of my life, necessarily. That's not the roots from which these concepts are sprouting. But church, on the other hand.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like if someone came to me like that, I think I've had conversations like that. And I think that the way I try to approach it is simply to honor whatever is pulling at them. Mm. And just to say, look, if something's in there, it may not be my church. I mean, you may come to my church and think, wow, this really is a bunch of bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, I know you. You're definitely not that good of a person, or you're definitely
me.
No, I'm talking about whoever's talking to me. That's like, I've seen you yell at your wife or your kids, or I've seen you be like, I don't, you know, or whatever weaknesses I display sometimes or whatever. But I really think that if someone's coming to that question, that the answer's already there, like the God's already at work. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's more like, well, if you're asking the question, why don't you come and just see what happens? I mean, maybe nothing will happen. Maybe it's a false alarm. Maybe something will, you know? And it might, you know, I don't think I'm that good of an evangelist. I don't think I'm that good at, like, quote unquote, converting people. But I have seen moments when people have come out of the street, or people I've never seen have come to church and just started crying at communion. Mm-hmm. Like just like red faced weeping. Mm. And it's because something happened, something clicked. And if someone's asking me the question, like, why should I come to church? You know, I would say, well, why are you asking the question? What's down there? You know, what's happening inside of you that's making you ask that question? And if you're worried about your friends making fun of you, like, your friends probably won't make fun of you.
Is it okay to come to church if the only thing you want to do is just sit quietly for an hour?
Yeah, that's fine. There's no bad reason to come to church you want to shoot people.
I agree. That's perhaps the one reason you shouldn't come. I feel like I'm asking the question a little bit out of just my own personal having asked the question for my wife, or answer the question to students who I, you know. But also for me, it's like going back to my beginnings. My introduction to the church was one in which you weren't allowed to ask questions.
Yeah.
You had to sit and go through these motions. And I feel like if someone had told me at that point, like, I'm not going to make you do anything. It's like going to hot yoga. Like the first thing they tell you at Bikram yoga is like, you just got to stay in the room.
Yeah.
And you will get some of the benefits out of this class. Right. That's all you got to do. Just be in the heat.
Right.
And I feel like church for a lot of people, the lay person who has had zero or had a really bad experience,
right?
It's hard for them to chew on the idea that church could simply just be a meditation.
Yeah,
and then whatever seeps in from there, is great. But if you just want an hour with other people, if you just want to have coffee with other people and be a civilized human being,
if you want to get out of your house,
could be an acceptable. Yeah. You don't have to come and flog yourself with a cat of nine tails and carry a cross down the street to prove that you were at church that Sunday. Right. I mean, some people do.
Well, who are you trying to prove that to?
Right.
Is that what, you know, I think it's something I read recently said that the Holy Spirit works for everybody, you know, in a little different ways, and you shouldn't judge the way the Holy Spirit works for somebody else. Mm. So, like, I may need a time. Like, I don't like praise bands.
Me neither.
I don't like light shows. You know, I like the church that I've got. I like the way that we worship.
I don't like the bouncy ball thing.
I don't like the bouncy ball thing. You know,
if you need a projector at your church, it's just an irrational hatred. It's not a real, like,
but some people, it's good. You know, for some people, that's great. You know, and that's good. I feel like if you're there, I feel like God's got you there. And like some people, you know, I remember one person said, you know, half the people in your church don't really believe in God. And I'm like, okay, well, they're here. I mean, they're giving money. They're giving time. They're shaking somebody else's hand. Mm-hmm. Like, who am I to? I can't look into their heart and say, like, oh yeah, this person is like 51% believing in God. Therefore, you know, check that box. You know,
well, and
like that's just bizarre to me. It's like the people can just come to church.
Well, and it's like if you look back at going to England, for example, like some of the early Reformation churches, like those so humongous and intense and just yes.
Yeah.
They were built like that because you had to put on a show for the people because they didn't believe in God. Like,
that's right.
You can't just rely on everybody's blind faith. Yeah. You got to put on a show and have candles and stained glass and trillions of dollars of artwork.
Yeah, that's right.
And you got to light things on fire. Yeah. And you're going to wave a little ball that smells like shit at people. And they're going to be like, I don't know why this smells terrible, but I got to sit quiet. Like, you got to put on a show. You got to write a new sermon every week. You got to do your dance. You
got to
wear rad clothes because people don't believe in God. And maybe if you get them to sit there long enough for the show, some of it might seep in.
There's a great book called Augustine and the Catechumenate, which is, of course not. Why would anybody read that book?
I don't know the most niche thing you've mentioned today, John. I'm sorry.
Augustine the Catechumenate, but I love it because, like, I love Augustine and I love the Catechumenate, and I thought, oh, what a great title. But this book was like this, this priest was writing about Augustine as a pastor, which, you know, Augustine, everybody thinks about as like this, you know, crazy, whacked out theologian. He's actually a bishop, you know, and a pastor, and had real responsibilities. And we can tell because they so he had like these two scribes that like did like live blogging of his sermons, you know, mm-hmm. they would like, and Augustine got up and sat down and then wrote said this, and they wrote down what he said, and they could, you can tell like what the church service was like based on, so like people had their favorite Bible verses and they would like shout when they heard it coming and like roar, and then they would heckle Augustine like if he wasn't doing a good job that day or if they disagreed with him or whatever. And
it's like being at like the Laugh Factory or something, yeah. like some comedy show.
Yeah, no, but it was like, you know, Augustine, you know, was trained in rhetoric and was apparently a great rhetorician and a great preacher, but it was a real live wire experience. Like, you went to church and something, and like, even if like God didn't happen, like, there was shouting and cheering and crying and like farting and giant church building, like a two-story building that, you know, it's like if you're in North Africa, there was nothing else like it around, and all this cool stuff. And I think that that's just, it's part of like engaging when people, like the thing I love about what you do is that like you're banging on stuff and making music and it's just amazing. It's just amazing. And you're doing it with three other guys and you're working together and something beautiful is happening. You know?
But I do think that there's, I've said all along that I think there's a lot of similarities between what I do and what you all do.
Yeah.
Except you have to write a new piece every Sunday. I get to perform the same piece every time I do a show, or not the same piece, but the rep is the same.
Yeah.
But you have to write a new sermon every Sunday and you have to perform it. You have a gig every Sunday.
That's true. And during Lent twice, and then sometimes if you're covering, you got more. But
probably around 70 gigs a year that you have to perform. And that doesn't include funerals and weddings.
Right.
I don't know that I play that many shows throughout the year. But I also have to put on a show. Why? Because the vast majority of people at some point during our show is going to be like, that's kind of bullshit. Even the ones who are diehards are at some point going to be like, I'm bored. And then that's when you get the cactus out and you stroke it. And they're like, oh, cactus. You know, and you could keep them. And then hopefully it seeps in a little bit. And the next time they come back, they're a little less bored or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I believe that. I guess I don't feel like, I feel like I have to earn it a little bit. Like, I have to assume that not everybody in the room is as in love with this as I am.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the world would be way less interesting if everybody... If you love John Cage as much as I do, so did your Jane, and so did Claire, and that's all everybody talked about is how awesome Steve Reich was. Steve Reich would be a far less interesting person.
Yeah.
So, in terms of, like, God, like, there's a reason not everybody is as a diehard as you or my wife, Stephanie. But some of you are.
Yeah.
And your role in those moments can't be to assume that everybody in the room is on the same page.
If there's one thing I've learned as a pastor, whoever I'm preaching to, there's someone in that room who's way better at this than I am.
Mm.
Like, way better at being a Christian than I am, who's got much more interesting things to reflect on. Like I'm chosen by the church to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But like the people that I preach to every Sunday, like their stories are way more interesting than mine a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I think. And I think that they teach me too. You know. And I think the one thing that's cool about God is that I think God is the thing that like never doesn't get boring. Or never, sorry, that was wrong. Never ever is boring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think about, like, I think that we have this idea of heaven is like this great, I call it the great cruise ship theory.
Mm.
And it's like everything's like now, but a little bit nicer and free, and you know, there's plenty of it.
Except
but
everybody's got diarrhea.
Everybody's getting the measles.
The norovirus. Everybody's...
It's helicopters taking people to, like, nearby hospitals. Everybody's sleeping with the cabin crew or something.
Right.
But that's not what it is. I mean, it's more like this experience that is unexplainable and is it like takes the greatest joy we've ever felt on earth and just blows it out of the water. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what God is. And so, I don't know. That's why, you know, Jonathan Edwards said that heaven is people singing sweetly to one another. It's mm-hmm. it's music.
Mm-hmm.
Because for him, he couldn't think of anything that was more joyful and completely transporting than people singing together.
Mm. Wow. John, I think that's a perfect, I actually think that's a really good place to wrap up. Okay. And when I've said this to anybody I've talked to that I like return guests. So
sure.
At any point down the line, you want to get together and pick up where we left off. Let's, well, let's do it. Okay,
well, if you're ever stuck in the city one night and can't get back to Connecticut, you need a place to crash.
It may or may not happen a few times, so watch your back.
Okay.
Forget, you know,
I got a big church. You're welcome. You're welcome
regret
to come.
What you're wish, yeah. what
you know what we should do is bring a bunch of people who, like, don't... Like, we should have, like, a talk about people who are, like, on the fence or really militantly atheist about God and talk about God together.
I would love to do that. I've been trying... I would love to get together with, like, you and Kim and Stephanie and have, like, a bunch of pastors sort of chew the fat. Because, like, it's really interesting to me when we all do hang out. I mean, it doesn't happen a whole lot, but the few times it does, it's clear that you all are on the same page as far as human beings are concerned. Like, everybody loves each other.
Yeah.
But when you start to drill down and you get down to sort of the basement floors, and you're like, oh, wow, they really don't agree on that issue.
Well, isn't Kim a Unitarian?
What's that? Kim's a Unitarian.
Yeah. See, that's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I like her very much. She's a very nice person.
But, you know, but it's like, even you and Stephanie are not...
Yeah, we're not totally, we're different.
Well, she hates you. I mean, she thinks you're terrible, so...
I know. I mean, that's just logical, though. It's anybody who gets to know me.
I think it would be amazing, though, to get together and sit with a few folks who just don't... I mean, I think I know more than the average layperson does about the Lutheran religion.
Yeah.
But it'd be great to have some folks in here who do think it's BS.
Yeah, and I love talking to people like that.
Well, let's
because you know why? Because it's so different from me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's well, and at the end of the day, like, you know, they're people. So
yeah.
Well, John, I really appreciate your time, buddy.
Me too, man.
And the awkward. Sorry, that was my bad.
I don't know what we're doing.
We're gonna try it again. There it is.
Yeah,
there it is. Are there any resources folks could check out to find out about like things you're passionate about?
Augustine and the Catechumenists.
Can you spell it very slowly?
Sure, no. I have so much great stuff. I think there's like, but mostly they're books. So, well, Fleabag, season 2.
Ayn Gordon, a friend of mine, just recommended that. I have not seen
that. That's got a great sermon at the last.
What platform is it on?
It's Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, okay.
I'm sure you can get it on DVD. That's good. And then there's also this really great book called My Bright Abyss. Okay. And then any novel that Marilynne Robinson writes, her essays are pretty like... You got to bring your machete and like be ready to kind of hack some stuff to get through those. But like any novel that Marilynne Robinson has written, especially Gilead or Lila,
okay,
I think Lila is a beautiful book about God.
All right,
so they should check that out.
All right,
and if not, they should just listen to Bach.
It's true. He was like God's Miles Davis,
or like Sufjan Stevens, or something. Like,
it talks about like improvisation or improvisers, and they're like John Coltrane. I'm just like. Bitch, Bach was like one of the OGs. That dude had to make up a whole cantata every Sunday. It had to just
and he was taking care of like 30 boys.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
which means
plus his kids.
He was procreated. He procreated like 30 times.
That's right. Like, well, plus his children's choir. What is it like? He had to like lug his kids and his children's choir around.
That's where
Leipzig?
The children's choir was invented, wasn't it? Just because Bach had to. His wife is just like, uh-uh, yours today.
Yeah, yours today. It's like, okay, we're gonna sing. You're all gonna go, oh. Did you know he shipped somebody?
Wait, Bach shipped somebody?
I think so. He got a knife fight when he was young.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Please tell me that's true.
Yeah, it's true. He got into a knife fight. I don't know if he actually stabbed the dude, but it was like it was scandalous. He was a hothead.
I think in order to do what he did, I think you'd have to be some sort of crazy.
Soli Deo Gloria, man.
And with you. And also with you. John, thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome, Josh. Thank you.
Okay, don't you think for a second that I'm going to talk a bit over Aretha Franklin, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Aretha Franklin Live. Mary, don't you weep.
Listen, Mary.
Mary, don't you
Master, don't moan. Review the story of two sisters called Mary and Martha. They had a brother named Lazarus. One day while Jesus was away,
don't you leave on me. Jumeaux.